Hello, and thank you for joining this medcast entitled Beyond the Surface: Monitoring Your Patients with Moderate to Severe Plaque Psoriasis. My name is Dr. Linda Steingold, and I'm the Director of Dermatology Clinical Research at Henry Ford Health System in Detroit, Michigan. And today I'm thrilled to be joined by my friend and colleague, Dr. Bruce Strober. Welcome, Bruce.
Thank you, Linda. I'm Bruce Strober. I'm a clinical professor of dermatology at Yale University, Department of Dermatology, and I practice at Central Connecticut Dermatology in Cromwell, Connecticut. It's a real pleasure to be here today.
Thrilled to have you. In today's program, we'll be discussing exciting developments in the treatment landscape of plaque psoriasis. We will focus on providing practical monitoring tips during systemic therapy for psoriasis, which may be implemented by practitioners in routine clinical practice. We'll also review recently published long-term data on the TYK2 inhibitor deucravacitinib to help guide your therapeutic decision-making in clinical practice. Thanks, everybody, so much for joining. And Bruce, let's go ahead and get started. When we think about psoriasis, this was the first of the inflammatory skin diseases that taught us that the inflammation was more than skin deep. We understand there are potential systemic manifestations. We know that patients who have severe psoriasis are more likely to die of a heart attack than those patients with mild psoriasis or even no psoriasis. Bruce, can you comment? What else do we worry about in terms of other comorbidities in these patients?
For me, there are two major comorbidities that are highly prevalent in people with psoriasis. The first one actually is obesity. Patients with psoriasis are highly more likely to be obese than the general population or overweight. And the reasons for that are probably multifactorial, but the primary one might be the genetics of psoriasis and the cytokine balance or the irregularities of the cytokines with psoriasis mirror those we see in patients with obesity. So there could be a genetic underpinning for obesity and psoriasis. Not as much do I believe it's the reclusive nature of patients with psoriasis that leads to obesity. I just don't think that's as big a deal. It used to be thought that was the issue, but I think there's a genetic and pathophysiologic link between obesity and psoriasis. And then secondly is psoriatic arthritis. Probably a little less frequent than people with obesity, but psoriatic arthritis is, a very sizable minority of patients, especially as we get more severe skin disease. And psoriatic arthritis itself is a misnomer. It's not just arthritis, it's ligament inflammation and tendon inflammation. So enthesopathy is a major part of it. And so those two major comorbidities guide me when I first see patients, and the addressing of both of them is actually fundamental to the initial visit. Now, there are other comorbidities. You mentioned cardiovascular risk, and I think that's no doubt huge, higher rates of heart attack and stroke. There's probably more renal disease. There's more psychiatric illness like depression, possibly more suicide. There's conflicting data on that issue. And then behavioral issues such as alcoholism come into play as well. So, and smoking. So, there's a lot that needs to be addressed, not necessarily in the first visit, that's for sure, but the major ones being obesity and arthritis.
Do you think we're underdiagnosing the arthritis?
Without question, as a specialty, we do perhaps in a large percentage, if not the majority of visits for patients with psoriasis, the presence of arthritis isn't detected because it's not being asked about. And I understand that because it somewhat involves a deeper understanding what defines psoriatic arthritis, and the provider needs to know how to query patients appropriately to detect its presence. But it has to be scanned for. At the initial visit, it's always a part of my questioning. It's only about 30 seconds to really understand whether the patient possibly has psoriatic arthritis. So it should be done more of that, and we don't do it well as a specialty. It's an ongoing battle. It's been going on for a couple decades.
And as you mentioned, all these comorbidities, it really hits home the fact that these are patients that have to have a team of physicians who really coordinate their care. It can't just be the dermatologist. We have to make sure they're plugged in with an appropriate primary care physician, because there are so many issues beyond the skin. And, I think we're the ones who have to make sure that not that we take care of all these, that the patient is appropriately plugged in to make sure that these are all addressed appropriately, including the potential for anxiety and depression, which can be just devastating for these patients. So Bruce, you know, traditionally we used to talk about these mild, moderate, and severe psoriasis patients, and we had these kind of hard lines on them, you know. Severe psoriasis was 10% body surface area or greater, and mild was, you know, 1 or 2%, and moderate was somewhere in between. And we've come to understand that this just doesn't really, these hard guidelines just don't really work in our psoriasis population. And we've changed our mindset on how we look at the severity of disease. Can you comment on that now?
I think it's really easy, Linda. A patient is either appropriate for topical therapy and just topical therapy, or they're appropriate for systemic therapy / phototherapy, with or without topical therapy. And to me, that is a gestalt determination a provider can make. But there are some hard and fast rules. One, if they're 10% or more, that's a patient who belongs on a systemic drug. I don't believe topical only really belongs in a patient with 10% or more body surface area. It's too much. Second, if they have failed topical therapies, in other words, they've run through a bunch at any BSA, doesn't matter what their BSA is, if they've run through a bunch of mechanisms of action, topical therapies, old or new, they should be considered for a systemic therapy. And finally, what we call special areas of involvement, regardless again of their BSA, so hands and feet, scalp, genitals, nails, maybe inverse, you know, all these areas that are limited in BSA, but very impactful in quality of life. I call them high impact limited disease, HILD. No one wants to take on that acronym. So we just call it special areas. So really bad scalp psoriasis, really bad palmoplantar. And that's not to say you don't start that kind of patient on a topical right out of the gate and see how they do. But you should be really comfortable to quickly jump to systemic therapies. Now you can see basically I'm disregarding BSA. That's what needs to be done. You disregard BSA. You look at what the patient has, what they've been on, and how their disease impacts quality of life. And you more likely will go to a systemic therapy in many of these patients. You'll use it earlier. And ultimately, it'll be easier for patients. I always say treating from the inside out is many ways, manyfold easier than treating from the outside in with topical therapy often.
You know, I used to refer to those patients who had a little bit more limited disease as the forgotten stepchildren, because, yeah, you know, you have 20% BSA, boom, I'm going to get you on a biologic or an oral drug and I'm going to get you under control. With more limited disease, which sometimes can be more difficult to treat, you know, we weren't often looking at the broad spectrum of treatment options that we have available. And I think it's a much healthier approach to our patients to approach them exactly the way that you mentioned. You know, it really is a win-win for all of those involved. So let's talk a little bit about when we decide to go to a systemic therapy. We have so many systemic options, and we're dealing with patients who, as we mentioned, have a number of comorbidities. It gets confusing as to what is appropriate, and does it depend on the particular medication in terms of monitoring these patients? My first question to you, just as a very broad sense, if somebody is a patient for systemic therapy, do you think that that everybody needs some kind of baseline labs, or do you really think it's patient specific and drug specific?
Definitely the latter. Our newer crop of medications, by and large, really only require a baseline test for latent or active TB. So the basic laboratory evaluation is in my shop, QuantiFERON gold. And that's related to the use of any of these medicines. Now, there is this greater concept, do you draw a broader set of labs that are related to what are the comorbidities of psoriasis that you might consider following? So do you get a fasting lipid panel? Do you get a comprehensive metabolic panel? Do you get a sense of where their hemoglobin A1C is, because diabetes is enriched in patients with psoriasis? All of this is totally acceptable. Hepatitis B, hepatitis C, HIV, all of this is totally acceptable. It's not required for the use of these medicines. It's required if you're just doing a general approach to the person with psoriasis so that you can really discuss comorbidities, not that you have to manage them. So I like what you're saying. It's tailored. For some patients, you might envision doing a broader laboratory evaluation at baseline. But that said, as you treat with most of these drugs, and in fact, in my opinion, all of our modern drugs, regular follow-up laboratory evaluations are not necessary, beyond which what the general practitioner or primary care provider are doing during the course of that patient's annual examination for a physical examination. That's to me enough.
And that's just a really important point. So I'm from the school of, given the fact they have a number of comorbidities, given the fact maybe they drink a little bit of alcohol, maybe they're a little bit heavier than usual, maybe they have metabolic syndrome, I want all of my patients, especially with more significant disease, to have base general labs done generally once a year. Now, I like when the primary care physician does them and a complete evaluation. If somebody hasn't seen a primary care, I'll do it myself. And that's true, even if somebody, it's even borderline, a little bit more than just localized disease. So I think we agree that somebody should do it. You know, you should have a physical exam every year, not by me, but by your primary care, and all the appropriate labs should be done that are appropriate for you, given your general state.
I completely agree. And, you know, by the way, I said obesity is a major issue for psoriasis. It's everything that comes with obesity, which is the metabolic syndrome, hypertension, dyslipidemia, hypertriglyceridemia. All of that needs to be discussed with the patient. And I like what you're saying, Linda, where you would do a baseline set of laboratory evaluations just to get a sense of where the patient is. I mean, it's not even just with psoriasis medicines. In general, you might be starting isotretinoin on a patient, and you do their baseline lipids and you find like the 21-year-old with very off the chart dyslipidemia, at baseline. You literally have gotten a head start for that patient because you can plug them into a PCP and have it managed. It's that concept where you are screening in people who in general might be at higher risk, and then you refer appropriately. No one is asking the dermatologist to manage hypercholesterolemia or hypertension or diabetes for sure. That's something that's beyond our scope.
And I agree. I think the best thing we can do for these patients, especially those patients who require systemic medication, is make sure that they have a primary care physician. Because it really isn't up to us to manage it. But we know that most of them are going to have at least one comorbidity that needs somebody to manage it. So I think we're on the absolutely the same page. This is just good medicine.
Correct.
In general. So now let's talk a little bit, so we agree everybody should have a general physical by their primary care. You should have your appropriate labs done especially by your primary care. Let's talk a little bit more about monitoring, because this is something that comes up. So let's first start with the biologic drugs. Other than, they had their baseline physical, they've had, and a TB test is not something that's generally done by primary care. So that's something that we'll probably have to do. But other than that, if you're choosing a biologic drug, do you do any additional ongoing laboratory monitoring?
None. Zero.
Okay. Zero. Zero.
And many people don't get that. I mean, I get questions all the time. They're like, should I be following CBCs and serial quantiferons and chest x-rays? I said, no, you don't have to do any of that. That's the beauty of these drugs. They're very simple. So no, that's not something you need to do.
Okay, but I do have my patients, again, go back to their primary care every year and have their physical and everything else done. I do a TB test every year. And do you?
Nope. Only if the insurance requires it.
And often insurance does require it.
Only if they require it. Yep.
Yeah. And it depends on where you live and the specifics of your environment as to how prevalent TB is. We don't see it that commonly here in Michigan, but we do see it occasionally.
Well, the real point is that outside of the TNF inhibitors, which I rarely use now for psoriasis, the new mechanisms of action don't reactivate TB. They're just inert to TB. So, I could screen for HIV every year too, from that matter. I could screen for hepatitis C every year, but I'm only going to screen on a regular basis if I feel the therapies I'm using can somehow increase risk. And I don't believe the modern therapies have any effect on TB reactivation. The older ones do, like TNF inhibitors.
So now let's move to the oral agents. I first want to ask you, how often are you using the traditional oral treatments for psoriasis?
Well, not very commonly. For example, you're referring probably to methotrexate, acitretin, and cyclosporin. Mm-hmm. Probably most frequently is methotrexate, and least frequently is cyclosporin and acitretin. I just don't use those drugs for psoriasis at all. And it used to be a lot more common. We just don't need to. But methotrexate, I'm probably, biased in terms of my favorable opinion of that drug because I've been using it my whole career. I think it's relatively safe and it's easy. And it works in about 40% of people. And it certainly is a good choice in people with insurance hardship or for whatever reason you feel it's the right drug because you're comfortable with it and temperamentally you can manage it. Of course, it requires blood tests and proper patient selection. And it's not the easiest drug to talk about with patients because they can read up on it and they would be scared half to the moon. But that's the one I most commonly will use as of the older drugs.
And when people think about laboratory monitoring, when you think about our traditional agents, that was absolutely required on an ongoing basis to make sure that we were keeping our patients safe. So right. Monitoring is not a new concept. So let's right. Move now towards the next generation of oral therapy. We have apremilast, which has been approved now for many years. Mm-hmm. What's interesting about apremilast is there is no laboratory monitoring, and even a baseline TB test that is required. If you have a patient on apremilast, you still recommend, though, the yearly physical and just be managed by your primary care?
Yeah, I think that's a blanket recommendation that makes sense for all patients with psoriasis. Yeah, absolutely. But you're right. Apremilast is easily the most, it's the friendliest therapy we use because it does lack any need to monitor blood tests ever.
Okay. And then in terms of the oral landscape, we have deucravacitinib. So let's talk for a few minutes about this particular molecule. It's a TYK2 inhibitor, which technically is part of the JAK family. Can you help us to understand how is TYK2 different from JAK1, JAK2, and JAK3? Because we know with the approval of deucravacitinib, it has a very different label than our traditional JAK inhibitor. So help us to understand why that is.
Well, it comes down to the JAK kinases are similar to one another, all four of them, JAK1, 2, 3, and TYK2. It's how do you choose to inhibit them? So if you choose to inhibit the active site of a JAK kinase, including TYK2, you're inhibiting a conserved domain across all four. And therefore, a active site inhibitor, the catalytic domain, will be promiscuous. It'll bind and inhibit to some extent all four of those enzymes to differing extents. You can be selective, so to speak. You can be JAK1 specific, JAK1, 2, et cetera. But there's going to be some across the board inhibition. The reason why TYK2 inhibition specifically can be done is because you can take an inhibitor like deucravacitinib and target the regulatory domain, not the catalytic domain, of that particular JAK kinase, TYK2, and ignore the other three JAK kinase inhibitors' regulatory domains because there's less conservation in those amino acid sequences. The target of deucravacitinib and other drugs following on after it will be non-conserved domains across the family. So it's a very specific inhibition, and that is proven very nicely in vitro and in vivo. That deucravacitinib is highly selective for TYK2 at the doses we use it at. And that's a final point I'll make. If you use really high doses of any quote unquote selective inhibitor, it becomes less selective. It starts inhibiting other members of the family. So at the doses we give people, it's highly selective for TYK2 based on its specific binding to a non-conserved domain within TYK2.
Okay. And so I'm just going to summarize what you said. Basically, you've explained to us that deucravacitinib binds to the TYK2 molecule in an area that is not shared by the other JAK family members. So in doing so, we can target TYK2 and not have the collateral damage of hitting JAK1, 2, and 3. So, but Bruce, tell us, why do I care about TYK2 and psoriasis?
Well, first of all, you want to be selective with TYK2 because TYK2 modulates the cytokine activities we know are part and parcel of psoriasis. Primarily, it's IL-23. So TYK2 mediates IL-23 signaling through its receptor. And ultimately, IL-23 active signaling leads to differentiation of Th17 cells, which elaborate IL-17 isoforms. If you block TYK2's activity specifically, you specifically shot down IL-23 and IL-12 and interferon. It is not specific for IL-23, but I think the relevant input is the IL-23 receptor that's being inhibited. Other kinase members of that family, JAK1, 2, and 3. In fact, if you inhibit JAK1, 2, and 3 and TYK2, you can shut down psoriasis. And I know that because these non-specific JAK kinase family inhibitors, like upadacitinib, is a very effective psoriasis therapy. Though, when you start touching the other JAK kinases, 1, 2, and 3, you start incurring some increased risk for the patient. That's why you want to be specific for TYK2 and not touch JAK1, 2, and 3. The risks probably specific for inhibition of JAK1, 2, and 3 more have to do with infection and definitely with zoster and possibly thromboembolism. And cardiac risk. So the specificity of a TYK2 inhibitor abrogates some of those unpleasant adverse events, while rare, that are associated with the traditional catalytic inhibitors, and just focuses on the pathway relevant for psoriasis, that which is mediated through TYK2.
So that was a really great explanation because it does get confusing. So you're explaining to us then that by inhibiting TYK2, we're really more carefully selecting those immunologic abnormalities specific for psoriasis, and we're not hitting the downstream effects that we can see if we inhibit JAK1, 2, and 3 in terms of metabolic pathways. So yep. We try to avoid the areas that we prefer not to hit and just more focus on that immunologic pathway, as you mentioned, the IL-23 pathway that is more highly specific for psoriasis. So we've had this drug approved now for quite some time. In terms of oral agents, how does this drug, deucravacitinib, stack up? Let's talk first about efficacy. Because as you mentioned, if we're hitting one of the key axes in the pathogenesis of psoriasis, which is that IL-23, IL-17 axis, and if we try to block that, theoretically, this should be similar to what we see with some of our other known biologic agents, but this is in an oral form. How does it stack up in terms of other oral agents or just in general?
Well, there's no doubt that deucravacitinib is the best oral therapeutic ever approved for psoriasis. Its efficacy at the PASI 75 level at 16 weeks is approximately 2 out of 3 patients get to PASI 75. Depending on the study, it's going to range between 60 and 69%, depending on the study. There are 2 studies done. And so 16 weeks, 2/3 of patients are at PASI 75. And I really don't think there's another oral drug that can do that with the safety profile. I mean, maybe cyclosporine at its highest doses can hit that rate, but that's not a viable drug anymore for people with psoriasis. When you talk about efficacy, you talk about both short and long term, though. So deucravacitinib is not the most rapidly acting oral therapeutic. It definitely needs a nice 8-week run-in for patients to start seeing, in general, measurable, discernible efficacy. Of course, there'll be some patients who see it quick and some patients who see it later. It's on average 8 weeks. You never want to bring back a deucravacitinib patient at 4 weeks and say, how are you doing? And that we're going to size up how you're doing right here. Now, it's a drug that takes some time to really get rolling. So that's your short term, but its long term is great because its mechanism of action probably needs 4 to 6 months for full realization of efficacy. So make sure the patients are aware of that timeline when starting the drug.
So this is a small molecule. It works inside the cell. It's a little bit different from the biologic drugs in terms of the site of action. But are there specific areas where a small molecule really shines, like a palm and sole?
Without head-to-head, it's hard to say. And each small molecule is different. Mm-hmm. For palms and soles, I think certain small molecules are great and some are not great. So I don't think it's about the small molecule concept. Mm-hmm. I think it's about mechanism of action. Mm-hmm. For example, traditional JAK inhibitors that are not approved for psoriasis are the best palms and soles drug, mm-hmm. like tofacitinib and upadacitinib. They're really high efficacy palms and soles. Whereas I think deucravacitinib is in the middle on that front. But better than acitretin and better than perhaps methotrexate. It's right down the middle on palms and soles. Scalp, I would say the same. I don't think about the structure of the drug or its molecular weight. I think each of these drugs have different inherent abilities based on their mechanism of action to treat specific special areas and just general plaque psoriasis.
And it's interesting, Bruce, you know, when we think about the JAK1, 2, and 3 inhibitors, as you mentioned, some are used for psoriatic arthritis. But in atopic dermatitis, we know it's very fast on, it's very fast off, though. You stop the drug, it goes away. With deucravacitinib, do we see a little bit of a longer durable effect when you stop the medication?
I think that's true. And that was investigated in their phase 3 pivotal trials, where there was a randomized withdrawal of some patients and the return of psoriasis was relatively slow. And that goes with the IL-23 inhibition. Generally, drugs that target IL-23 allow forgiveness for discontinuation. Very different from, like you said, a JAK kinase inhibitor that's used for atopic dermatitis on off switch. Definitely. You're forgiven if you miss a dose or two. If you're on deucravacitinib, you're going to keep your response between those two off days that inadvertently you didn't take the medication.
Now let's talk about the adverse events of special interest a little bit. You know, and we've looked into this quite extensively because we know that there is no box warning with deucravacitinib, yet there is a very specific box warning that accompanies not only the systemic JAK inhibitors, but even topical JAK inhibitors. When we look at those AEs of special interest, and we look specifically at deucravacitinib or apremilast, because we did have a head-to-head study, is there a signal for instance, malignancy or thromboses or cardiac events with deucravacitinib? Because I know we looked at this very, very carefully.
I don't see one. And I've looked at their long-term data now out 4 years and their short-term data. I don't see a malignancy signal at all. And I'm looking hard. Mm-hmm. I don't see a thromboembolism signal. I don't see, importantly, a zoster signal. I think zoster is the canary in the coal mine, mm-hmm. for a lot of the drugs. If you see a zoster signal, what do I mean by that? Three events per 100 patient years, four events per 100 patient years. That's a typical JAK kinase inhibitor. But with deucravacitinib, it's less than one event per 100 patient years. And so that to me is a marker that this is a different MOA and warrants a different label. But the other issues are also highly different. We're forgetting to talk about laboratory abnormalities with deucravacitinib. There are really none. Yes, the label points out triglycerides. If you really look at the triglyceride excursions and people on dacarbazine, they're very small. They're nothing to write home about. The average elevation in a population is about 10 milligrams per deciliter over the course of a year. That's nothing. You know, when we get upset about triglycerides, maybe we're talking about 2 to 3-fold upper limit normal. We're not seeing that at all with deucravacitinib. So essentially, the things we think about with traditional JAK kinase inhibitors, which are occasional laboratory abnormalities, CBC abnormalities, liver tests, renal, CPK, you know, most of that's not really being detected. Maybe a little CPK elevation with deucravacitinib, but you don't really need to act on it. It doesn't have clinical meaning.
And that's important because we do, when we read the label, they do call out the triglycerides. They also call out patients who have a baseline liver
disease. Yeah.
And that's somebody, I think, in any with any medication, if they have liver disease at baseline, you're going to want to just kind of follow those patients closely. But I think that's where that baseline primary care, you know, overall assessment mm-hmm. of the patient certainly comes in, again, with deucravacitinib, as it would with any patient who has significant disease. So you don't feel the need then to check, not only say they have baseline, but you're not going to check at month 3 or month 6, the triglycerides, the LFTs, the CPK. You're not going to do an ongoing monitoring of that.
I'm not, based on the data. And that to me is what it's all about. If you look at their studies on deucravacitinib, they were all head-to-head with apremilast, first and foremost. And the apremilast and deucravacitinib laboratory abnormalities and excursions are highly comparable to each other, except for the slight elevations in triglycerides and CPKs you see with deucravacitinib that you really don't see much of with apremilast. But to me, they're so small and inconsequential, they don't warrant regular monitoring outside of what, as you were saying, Linda, that annual visit to their primary care provider.
You know, Bruce, often we only have data, you know, for the first 16 weeks. Fortunately, with deucravacitinib, the phase 3 went for 52 weeks, and that's nice. But I think it's much more reassuring when we follow these patients over the course of long term. And we've had some 3-year data that's been published, and you were an author on the 4-year data that's recently been published. What kind of changes are we seeing from year to year to year that I need to be worried about?
None. There are none. I mean, I tried fine-tooth combing these data. I just don't see anything new occurring year 2, 3, and 4 that wasn't occurring year 1, which was very little then. So I'm very comforted by the long-term data, not indicative of a cumulative toxicity or new kind of toxicity that might be seen with long-term use of a medicine. Malignancy would be your primary candidate for long-term immunosuppression. There doesn't appear to be lymphoma, leukemia. There's baseline non-melanoma skin cancer. There's not elevated non-melanoma skin cancer rates. So very comforted by the long-term data on all fronts.
And we also have efficacy data out long-term. Are we starting? And it's hard, I know, as we get to year 3 and year 4, we certainly have mm-hmm. some dropouts. People move, things happen. But are we starting to see the drug really losing effect as patients are on it over the course? Is it really starting to trend down with time?
As you said, there's always going to be patients who fall out, who lose efficacy on every drug. You know, for whatever reason, psoriasis tends in some patients every year to evade your mechanism of action of choice and start allowing some treatment failure. So I never like to talk to an audience and say, oh, this drug works for everyone and keeps working 100% of the time. It just doesn't happen. But what you can say is the majority of patients who are doing well at year 1 are still doing well at year 2, 3, and 4. So that's good. And you just have to emphasize adherence at that point. With every drug I use, when a patient comes in follow-up and they're still doing well a couple of years on drug, now I'm just nervous that they're not using it. They're starting to slack off. Mm-hmm. And that does lead to loss of response. So I just, It's a very nice retention of efficacy with deucravacitinib in patients who do well up front and stay on drug and take it.
So we have now these new options and we have the new oral option. In your practice, how would you choose a patient that you think would be a good candidate for an oral option like deucravacitinib? What do you look for in the patient?
You know, there's something intellectually and temperamentally right about a much lower BSA patient who's still systemic appropriate getting an oral therapy. I don't have a problem with biologics in any kind of patient, but I do know that some patients seem more amenable to an oral option. And especially if they're kind of, you know, in the 3-8% range, yet definitely are deserving of a systemic. You can't get them better with a topical. That patient just is, you know, all of us know what we're talking about. You know, that's just right. Let's try an oral. And I think deucravacitinib, like I just said, is the best oral. And that would be my choice at that point, because it's once daily and it's really well tolerated. Maybe a few patients get acne and you just warn them about it. Usually that's not a showstopper. But otherwise, very well tolerated. Like we just talked about, I don't feel the burden of laboratory evaluations. So visits can be easy and spaced out. And if, you know, you give it a 6-month trial, 4-6 month trial, and you see where it what happens.
What about a scalp patient? Somebody's scalp with some other body?
Well, scalp only or scalp majority or scalp biased is a real beast. I think it can be very tough to treat. And even our best biologics can fail. And so I don't think you're on poor footing to start with an oral therapeutic like deucravacitinib in the scalp. Fine. If you like a apremilast, go for it. I mean, I just think it's a lower batting average drug. That's the way I express it. I think deucravacitinib is a higher probability of success. But scalp only is hard. I would just encourage you again to not render a verdict with scalp-only disease at week 4. I mean, week 8 onward is when you're talking to the patient about how well they're doing.
And I think that's such an important point to let people understand what are our expectations over time. You know, a lot of times people are starting a new drug and they're going to be calling you next week and say, so I'm not seeing anything, you know? But to be honest, sometimes within the first few weeks, they see a decrease in their itching. Maybe they feel a little bit better. A lot of patients have that kind of achy bones and muscles and they don't even realize maybe they have a little touch of arthritis and don't mm-hmm. even know it. And they just say, hey, you know what, for whatever reason, I'm feeling a little bit better. But yeah. I think it's so important to make sure we set appropriate expectations so that the patient knows upfront, this is what I should expect. This is what my physician has told me. And that way everybody's on the same page. Any final thoughts about just getting these patients systemic eligible, systemic appropriate patients on appropriate therapy?
I think you're much more likely to have success when you use systemic drugs, especially our modern ones, versus topicals for these patients. And topical churn and cycling is a problem in our specialty that we need to break free of. I think patients, once they have buy-in that the systemic is safe, and that's your job to explain it to them, that it's safe, ultimately value highly the ease and efficacy of these systemic drugs. They ultimately are very easy. And the reason why I think it's great for dermatologists to move over towards systemics is it makes medicine more enjoyable, in my opinion. You get more treatment success. Your visits are easier because the follow-ups are generally happier and briefer, and the patients are much more appreciative. You know, all of us know how to take oral medicines. Not all of us know how to do injectables, but they too can be taught. And frankly, we have to view the skin as a organ. And like we treat other organs in the body with systemic therapies, almost always, we have to view the skin as just an organ we treat with systemic therapies, even though it's visible and we're always trained about topicals first. if we really are respecting the organ about which we are experts, we're bringing to bear systemic therapies earlier because we're going to achieve better things.
I agree with you. We are in such a new world for the treatment of psoriasis, and we have the tools today to get most of our patients to a state of clear, almost clear. And Bruce, I agree with you. It's really our responsibility to become knowledgeable about the tools that we have, educate ourselves on what to expect, how to use them appropriately, how to pick the right patients, and we really can get our patients to a much better place. So Bruce, I want to thank you. This has been such a wonderful, rich, and informative discussion. I'd like to thank our audience for tuning in. If you have enjoyed the content, please subscribe to the newsletter e-newsletters to receive upcoming MedCast episodes and other great content right in your inbox. Thanks so much.